Is the tape running? Okay. What we're doing is routing. Routing is the act of creating virtual wires so that you can send packets from one machine to another. Routers work on interfaces. The only thing that you can connect TCP/IP to is a router interface. You can't connect it to anything else. A router interface is any hardware connection to TCP/IP data. You'll find things like Ethernet, token ring as your LAN interfaces, synchronous serial interfaces, which represent leased lines, and asynchronous for dial-up. Now remember that the point always when you put a wire down and a router at each end of it is to send an IP packet, which is the basic data unit in the internet, have it leave one machine, go down that wire, come off the wire at the other end, and still be the same IP packet it was when you put it in. The wires have to do different things based on what kind of wire they are. Ethernet's different than leased lines, different than modems. The actual electrical activity there is very different. There's also some software activity that has to happen on lines that are more complicated, like Ethernet, where you hang multiple things off the wire, versus a single wire that just goes from one point to another point. These become data encapsulation formats. On an Ethernet wire, your IP packet is actually encapsulated by being put as data inside an Ethernet packet. The Ethernet packet goes down the wire because it knows how to travel over that kind of electrical medium. At the other end, the Ethernet headers and stuff are taken off and the IP packet's back out of the middle as data, and it's taken back out of its encapsulation inside of an Ethernet packet. So it's like envelopes, and you're putting your IP in an envelope. That kind of envelope knows how to travel that kind of wire, and then the data is taken back out of the envelope at the other end. The envelope is encapsulates. They use the word capsule. Somebody was medicine at some point, I guess. It's like you put your data in a capsule that can survive the trip, then it takes the data out of the capsule at the other end. Just like those big pneumatic things where they put them in the hose and go whoop and it sucks it through the building and then they open it up and take it out at the other end. That's also a very good way to look at it. Absolutely. Now, every term that I'm about to tell you pertains to nothing else in your life except what kind of a capsule did I put your data in. And the capsule is different for different kinds of wire. Ethernet is an encapsulation protocol that goes on Ethernet type of wires. PPP is an encapsulation protocol that goes on a lot of different kinds of wires. It was designed to be flexible enough and have a lot of options so that it can work on a variety of wires. And that's why you can use PPP on a dial-up modem, or you could also use it on a leased line. Frame relay is an encapsulation protocol that is designed to be used in statistical multiplexing packet switch networks. But it's just the same thing. It's another kind of carrier. You can put your data in, fire it down the channel, and have your data come out on the other end the way it went in. And you also use SLIP or PPP on dial-up lines. SLIP is another encapsulation protocol. It's about as simple an encapsulation protocol as you can get. It's kind of like sticking a post-it note on your data. Some of these, like frame relay, are industrial strength. It's like building a cargo container and sticking your data in it. But conceptually, remember that all an encapsulation protocol does is provide a carrier to put your data in so it can go down the kind of wire it has to go down and come out on the other end. Yes?
You just referenced different things like post-it note and cargo carriers.
No, it reflects on what kind of wire the data is going down. The question was, I just referenced things like a post-it note versus a cargo container. Does that refer to the strength of the carrier, and are some better than others? I assume is sort of the underlying implication. The answer is no. If I'm going to pass a note, if I'm going to put a note from my desk and I'm going to lay it on your desk for you to come in the morning and find, it's going through a pretty tame environment, so I'll stick a post-it note on, so you'll say, this is a note from Phil. I know where this note came from now, and it's for me, so I understand I'm supposed to take it. I'll take this note off, and now I'll look at the data. It didn't have to be any more than that. It'd be pretty silly to bring a cargo container in here and pack it all up to get it from my office to yours across the room. On the other hand, if I want to send it to Anthony here in Venezuela, I'm probably not going to put a post-it note on it and drop it in the mailbox. I'm going to have an envelope. And if I think that it's going to go a great distance, I might put it in a cardboard envelope because it's heavy. Mostly, though, I need to put it in the kind of envelope that service needs. I would not put it in a Federal Express envelope and hand it to a UPS carrier and expect it to get there. That sounds silly. That is exactly what this is all about. If the other end is waiting for a PPP packet and you put a slip packet in at your end, it's not going to happen. It's the wrong kind of envelope. All this is a transportation medium based on the kind of wire. Yes?
Why is slip going away in favor of PPP?
The question is, why is slip going away in favor of PPP? Because the PPP envelope has one feature that makes it very much more powerful, and that is that the dynamic address can be conveyed inside the packet rather than in front of the packet. When you do slip with dynamic addressing and dial-up mode, you have to negotiate the address as part of your script. You have to have a dial-up script. With PPP, you do not need that. There's a part of the protocol that will let you exchange the address, and there's another part of the protocol that will let you exchange a logon ID and password. Slip does not do that. That all has to be done outside the protocol at startup. I refer to this in the download, it's like the Z modem issue. Why did Z modem win the protocol wars? Because it started automatically. And it restarts if you have an error. And it did not matter what the rest of the protocol did when it did those two things. Other protocols could be 1,000 times superior to it in other ways, and they still were not proved because human beings picked the two or three comfort features they wanted. PPP, in a dial-up environment, you're very much related to human beings making the connection. So the protocols that take over there are going to be the ones that take care of the human being, not the electrical line. So that's really a lot why that happened. But both of them are still in fairly heavy use, but the transition to PPP came mostly because it's very complicated, like Z modem. It didn't implement easily. Slips like the X modem, you can write it in 5 minutes. PPPs like Z modem, you can write it in 5 years. Yes?
Once you're connected, there is no practical difference.
It's just like Z modem and Y modem. There's difference in that one's not the same as the other, but in terms of effectiveness or what they do, they're very equivalent. PPP is actually a little bit slower than SLIP. This is the old Z modem, Y modem, G issue. Y modem G was faster than Z modem, but it didn't matter. And the difference is extremely marginal. It's a tenth of a percent difference or something in speed. It's not much different. Again, remember, however, in encapsulation protocols, it's just an envelope to put your data in, make it go down the wire, and come out the way you put it in. And it's based on the wire type you use. It's not based on anything else. And as in the Federal Express envelope to a UPS carrier, you have to have the same expectations of what type of envelope you're using on both ends. And those envelopes are called encapsulation protocols. Now let's look at the basics router's job. I've talked about it in getting to this point, but I want to very much focus in on it. When an IP packet is received by a router on any of its interfaces, the router's job, its only job, is to decide which interface should I send it back out of. It's nothing but, if you want to look at it this way, a data switch. A router has multiple interfaces. Packets come to it through those interfaces. And when its whole job is to look at each packet it receives and decide which interface that I have, should I put the packet back out? That is a router's entire life. A router doesn't do anything else. Now, in that, it has to know about the kinds of envelopes that are going to be hooked to its interfaces, because it's going to have to open that envelope and take the IP packet out in order to receive it. It makes all its decisions on IP packets that look the same now to it, no matter what interface they came from, because they've been taken out of any encapsulation protocol. And then when it puts that packet back out of an interface, it may have to re-encapsulate it in a different protocol in order to send it out that kind of wire. So a router handles encapsulation protocols to talk to wires, and it just gets IP packets through interfaces. And its entire life is, okay, it came in, now where am I supposed to put it out? And if it has nowhere to put it out, it will generate an error message back to where it came that says, this packet you sent me died here because I don't have any place to send it. Now this brings us to one other part that you're saying, well, the point of this was to connect client programs to server programs, and if routers can't do anything but push them back out interfaces, how does it get to or from the program? And the answer is, on machines that are either server hosts or clients, the router in that machine has an extra interface called the internal interface. And the internal interface to that router connects to the local TCP/IP protocol stack that then connects to the software that runs on that machine. So you have a program underneath it, the TCP/IP protocol stack that knows how to build IP packets or take data out of them going back the other way. And at the bottom of that stack is an internal interface that hooks to the router that runs on that machine. And that becomes the internal interface. So ultimately, when a client sends a packet, it goes down the IP stack to build an IP packet for the data. That goes across the internal interface to the local router on that machine, which then, based on the address, will send it to the hardware, some hardware interface. When it's receiving packets that are destined for software on that machine, the router on that machine will receive through a hardware interface an IP packet that it detects from the address belongs to a program on this machine. And it will then send it to the internal interface of the router, which hands it to the TCP/IP protocol stack that now knows how to connect it to the software on the machine and to take the data out of the IP packet. So ultimately, routers only move IP packets from one interface to another. Yes?
So is that what Trumpet Winsock does?
Trumpet Winsock does exactly that. It is a router and an internal interface and a TCP/IP stack.
So once you install Trumpet Winsock on a computer on a LAN, it is TCP/IP enabled and can do this?
That's correct. And Trumpet Winsock itself is a router. It's a router with only two interfaces, the internal interface and the hardware interface. But a router becomes a router immediately when it has two interfaces, which they have to have. And if it has 500 interfaces, it's still a router. It's still doing the same thing, just a bigger amount of it. Yes?
To take this a little bit further, I played around with multiple protocol stacking on single hardware devices.
Yes?
Single cards, and found that very, very complex and hard to do. I found it was simpler to use two different cards. Now, what is so difficult about having multiple protocol stacks on one card?
It's just a jigsaw puzzle, and the more pieces you have in the puzzle, the tougher it gets. And ultimately, that is really the only reason it gets harder.
And that would just be able to package the packet
in different ways and route it to different softwares. What you're doing is, as you put those pieces together, you're kind of building more levels of routing. Because now you're saying, okay, I have a TCP/IP router, and I have software that has to go to a switch to get to that route. It's a TCP/IP router. Now you're building a router at the Ethernet level, too. When an Ethernet packet comes in, is that a TCP/IP packet? Yes, send it to the TCP/IP router. Is it an IPX packet? Yes, send it to the IPX router. Is it this? Is it that? So this is part of what I tried to say yesterday about every part of this is simple, but when you put a lot of pieces together, it gets very complex. And while every piece is simple, if you draw it out on a piece of paper, what you're doing, you basically can end up covering the paper with ink with all the lines of the different ways you're trying to connect all the pieces together. But in the midst of being overwhelmed by how complicated it looks, it's not complicated, it's complex. Because complicated means the pieces are hard. Complex just means you got a lot of them. But each piece is still simple. And it just it keeps me able to go back into the configuration wars one more time to remember, if I just figure the part out I'm supposed to be working with, it's going to be simple. The hard part is that there's 5,000 parts in here, and I don't know which one I'm supposed to be working on. But all of them are simple, ultimately. And that means that if you can grab something at one end and be very methodical about walking from one point to another point to another point to another point, like we did with DNS yesterday, no part of it was hard. Every piece was simple. The trick's to figure out which thread to grab at the end and to make sure as you're walking down it, you don't get distracted by all the other pieces that you're walking past. If you can do that, this is very simple to do. But that's the technology. And when you're overwhelmed, make an X on the paper, step back, take 3 deep breaths, and go back. Don't start trying to jump from point to point, because there's too many points, you'll jump to one that's not even hooked to where you are almost immediately, and then you'll be lost. So you've got to just be real systematic about walking from one end to the other of the thread you're on, and remember that you're always going to be real near a whole lot of other pieces that aren't really involved in what you're doing. But they are all going to, you know, call your name and say, come look at me, and get confused. So ultimately, this is what a router does. IP packets, receives them on an interface, sends them to an interface. There is an internal interface on any machine that has client or host software. If you look at a Cisco 2501 router, you can see all these pieces in a very simplified form. The router program sits here. IP packets fall in. Its job is, I have 4 connections. 3 of them are hardware ports, and one of them is an internal port, because I can be on the console and do telnets and pings and things. So there is internal host software, and there is an internal interface to get to it. Very simplified, but it's all there. Encapsulation protocols, you think of them as, you know, like a snake ate a rat. There's a bulge here on these lines that's the encapsulation protocol. So if this serial interface is a leased line and it's PPP encapsulated, the packet will come down here encapsulated in PPP. On this wire, the PPP part will be stripped off of it, and when it gets into here, it's an IP packet. When it's sent here, it's an IP packet, and let's say that's hooked to a frame relay line. The little bulge on here will stick all the frame relay stuff around it, send it down the line to wherever it's supposed to go. Any packet comes in here, all the frame relay stuff will be stuck off, taken off of it. If it's routed here, it'll be all PPP stuff will be put back on it, it'll be sent. This is an Ethernet, same thing. Ethernet taken off, IP packet comes out, IP packet has to go out this interface, it's put back in Ethernet and sent. That's the life of a router. And if you remember this picture, it stays simple. If you're talking about PPP slip, frame relay, Ethernet, you're talking about one wire. One and only one wire. Not any of the rest of it. If you've got two wires, one of them's frame relay, one of them's Ethernet, what do you have to have between them? A router. Why? Because they're different wires. And routers are the only thing that can hook wires together that have TCP/IP on them. Trying to put this in terms that you can deal with when you face real-world problems. Now, what happens if I have a frame relay wire and I have a router that doesn't handle frame relay protocol? You have to get one that does. But let's say the one I get that handles frame relay protocol won't handle PPP protocol. Then you get two routers. Is there a problem with this? No. I can hook one wire, one router that handles this protocol here, and put an Ethernet between here and here to this router that handles the other protocol that one doesn't. As long as you have one common protocol that you can connect them together with, and generally that's Ethernet, because Ethernet will let you hang 3 or 4 routers off of one connection to each other. It's building blocks. This is tinker toys, erector sets, however you want to look at it. Yes.
What if your router has, for example, multiple of the same kind?
That's fine. Multiple interfaces of the same protocol are just fine. Because if it can handle it on one, it can handle it on as many as you can plug into it. The problems come in when you have two protocols and you don't have a router that'll handle them both. Then you need two routers, one that can handle each one, or else go buy a new one that handles them both. But generally, you find yourself in this situation when you got one and you have to add one. Routing's based on the IP address. And this is where you have to know a little piece of technical data, and that's what's an IP address. You always see these IP addresses specified as four numbers with periods between them. These are the four individual bytes within a 32-bit IP address, expressed in decimal notation, done by somebody who really knew far too much and thought he was simplifying it. But that's another story. This is the hardest way in the world to try to figure out what's going on inside, to express the address this way. Every address is based, broken into two pieces, a network portion and a host portion. That network tells you what wire it lives on. The host tells you what computer on that wire it's part of. We're going to get to that a little bit more later. There are standard divisions, and this is where terms class A, B, and C network come up. It's where do I draw the boundary? Class A draws it here. That's the network, and these three are the host. Class B draws it in the middle. These two are the network, and these two are the host. Class C draws it here. All of this is a network, and this is the host. It's just a way to have more networks or more hosts. Net mask, another term you will run across. Net mask defines the boundary between net and host. That's all it does. Net mask tells you how many bits of this address are the network, and the rest of them are the host. That's all net mask does. Class A, B, and C addresses. I put this picture in here for those who want to spend time studying them. This is how they divide down to net and host. And this is the net mask that goes with each one. A net mask is formed by putting a binary 1 over every bit that is the network and a binary 0 over every bit that's the host, and then turning it back into this decimal notation. So if you have your first byte is network, a byte that's all 1s is 255. So we put all 1s over the network, all 0s over the host, we end up with a net mask of 255,000. Here the net mask for a class B is all 1s over the first half. So that's 255,255,000. And here net over the whole first three bytes and host over the last, 255,255,255,000. These first bits I've drawn in this drawing are how an address is classified as A, B, or C. They decided that Class A networks, if the first bit was a 1, so this was all done more than 25 years ago when computers were very, very slow. Spending the time to look at all 32 bits to make a comparison was very lengthy. So they made these addresses so that it could look at the first bit as soon as it arrived and be able to make a decision, is that a Class A or not? So they said if the first bit's a 1, it's a Class A. If it's a 0, it's not. It's something else. Then they said, now, if the first bit's a 0, it's not a Class A. So if the second bit's a 1, it's a Class B. And if the second bit's a 0, it's not. Then they said, if the third bit's a 1, it's a Class C. Otherwise, it's a Class D, which is multicasting, and you'll never run into it except on the M-bone. It's not anything you'll really naturally hit. But what's the fallout of this? It's going to take just a second to address the IP addressing crisis, as it's discussed. Class C networks are what we want. That turned out to be the one that really works. 256 computers on an Ethernet works out pretty good. When you say that if the first bit's a 1, it's Class A, and if it's a 0, it's something else, what did you just do? You said half of all possible addresses are Class A. If the first bit's a 0 and the second bit's a 1, it's a B. Otherwise, it's not. What did you say? Half of what's left is a B. Now you said a 0, a 0, and a 1 makes a Class C. What did you end up? 1/8 of all addresses are Class C. 7/8 are something else. That's why we have a crisis. Because we threw away 7/8 of the addresses right up front. That's why the crisis is solvable. All we have to do is decide not to quite do it this way someday, and we'll get 7/8 of the addresses back.
The Class A's
are for backbone networks. Concept is you had these huge networks that span the country with millions of machines in them. Yes, there's can only be 127 Class A networks, and 76 of them are assigned. But you can be sure that most of the addresses in them are not being used, because there's very few networks with 10 million machines in them. So even where they're using thousands and thousands of the addresses, they're not using most of them. So again, summary, this is really a summary. This should all be, oh yeah, I know that by now. Routing is the process of deciding which interface a received IP packet should be sent to. Each interface belongs to a different IP network. Now this, I just said, but I want to make it very strong, because this, when you actually go to set up routing the networks, this is one of the things that gets very confusing, because you're not used to this. You're used to hooking things to an Ethernet where everything is one network. You're not used to having two Ethernets and a router between them and having two networks that you're hooking together. Because you're not used to it, because when you hook a leased line up, you don't think of it as a whole network. It's a network with two computers on it, with the one that's on each end. It doesn't appear to you to be a network. But when you go to route, you have to treat it that way. And you have to know that's what it is. Because ultimately, routers connect networks. Which means if two wires don't belong to different networks, you can't put a router between them. What is that? That really comes up when you come to IP addressing. That means you have to have IP addresses on each wire that are parts of different networks. When you get to doing a lot of things, especially small things in a localized area, this can come up. And we'll get into how that's handled. That's where the process of subnetting comes up. That's how you make a network out of a piece of another network. Because you have to have two networks when you in your mind really only see one. Routing uses only the network portion of the IP address to decide. This is really saying the same thing as this. Both of these say the same thing. They just say them from the other side. If a router can only connect networks, then the only thing it routes is the network part of the address. And that inches us towards ever closer to router programming. When you program a router, you tell the router the rules. I mean, obviously, if its whole job is when I get a packet from an interface, I have to decide which interface it goes out, that decision has to have some set of rules by which it's made. What are the rules that a router uses? How does it make that decision? It makes that decision based on what's called a route table. The route table is the decision matrix a router uses. And a route table has three entries. You should now know why these three entries are totally sufficient to make a routing decision. If you've been keeping up with what we had here, it's gone a little fast, but if you took it all in, this should make sense. Network address, a network mask, and an interface name are the three entries in a line in a route table. What a router does is say, when it has an IP address, it uses the net mask and says, only look at this many bits of that address, compare it to this network address. If it matches, then this is the interface the packet should be sent out of. And that's how a router uses a route table. Again, this address here is 199.45.143.0 as a network address, and 255.255.255.0 as a mask. So if I give it the address 199.45.143.2, it's first going to say, okay, I'm not supposed to look at this part. I'm only supposed to look at this part. So it takes that, and it actually does a Boolean AND against the mask, which makes all the host bits go to zero. So it, 199.45.143.2 against this mask turns into 199.45.143.0 and matches this network, which means that packet would be sent out this EN0 interface. That's what a router does. That's all a router does, is it takes a packet, it takes that address, and it has a route table with one or more entries in it, and they can get huge. Backbone routing tables have tens of thousands of entries in them. But the process doesn't change. It takes the net mask in the table, check ANSI address, takes the network part against that net mask, and says, does it match this one? Now, there's a problem that comes up here. What if I have 199.45.0.0 against the 255.255.0.0 mask, and I say that goes out a different interface? That address of 199.45.143.2 would match both of those, wouldn't it? It would match this one, and it would also match the other one that was only looking at less of the address up front. That brings in a situation that the router has a very specific thing. The one that matched more is more qualified. It's still fitting in the bigger criteria if it matched a longer portion of the network. So the router finds the most qualified route in the table based on matching the most bits. So if it matches more than one, it's which one did I match more of? As a network sends the IP packet to that specified interface. That is literally all a router does. Now, there's a special kind of an entry that can come up out of this if you think about it. What happens if I say 0.0.0.0, 0.0.0.0, and put an interface on it? What did I just create? Well, what I created was, if I mask any address with 0, I'm going to get 0, aren't I? I made a mask that everything will match, didn't I? Absolutely everything will match that. However, it matches it on how many bits? No network bits, 0. Because the net mask has no length of network. So it matches everything, but it matches it on no network bits. What did I just create? Now I created a wildcard or a default. The only way that route will win is if it doesn't match anything else in the table. Because any other entry it matches will have at least one bit in it. And remember the most qualified route. So any other entry will be a stronger match. A more qualified match. So what I really created was an entry that will only be selected by the router for any IP address that doesn't match some other entry in the table. Yes, it matches everything, but it matches it with 0 bits, so it's the weakest possible match. And that's called a default route. You put that in when you have, like, a leased line that is a gateway to some big outside world, and you don't want to specify every possible address on the net, on the internet, and put an entry in here for every possible network on the internet. You put in this weakest possible route and send it out that interface, and then you specify with hard routes all those things that are not supposed to go out there. They're supposed to go somewhere else, and that tends to be not that many. So now you have a route table you can manage. Because you said, if it matches any of these things that are supposed to go somewhere else, put it where it's supposed to go. And if it doesn't match any of those, put it out this other interface, which is the big rest of the world is out here interface. Yes? Correct. The default is all zeros for both the net address and the net mask. And a net mask of all zeros will force any address to be a zero when you mask it out. And then it will match the net address of 0. But it will match it on no network bits, so any other match is stronger. Ethernet zero. This is I use this in the iPad. You name interfaces. In fact, in every router you name interfaces, and in the iPad you tend to name them with short names, but you can name them with long ones if you want. If this were a Cisco router, that might be the whole word Ethernet zero after it, because that's how they name their interfaces. Ethernet 1, Ethernet 2. What that is just the name of the interface. However the router you're configuring it does that, so that tells the router, if I match this, this is supposed to identify to the router what interface that means the packet should be sent out of. Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is the default route. Now that I did it, we'll put it on the paper here. Those of you who are reading ahead already got to see this. If there is no route for a packet, if you rebuild a routing table and then that has addresses you could feed it that wouldn't match anything, that means there is no route for that address. Because I compared it to the table and it fell at the bottom and it matched nothing in my route table. If there's no route for a packet, the packet is discarded by the router, and a destination unreachable message will be sent back to the originating address, saying, at this router, this packet could go nowhere. I just thought I'd tell you. And that's what happens when you are doing trace routes or pings or things and you get host unreachable or destination unreachable messages back. This is how it happened. It got to a router that had no route for that address, and it sent you back a message that said, I threw your packet away because I couldn't do anything with it. But I am going to send you back this Internet Control Message Protocol response that says, I did it.
Port unreachable.
Port unreachable happens at a different place. Port unreachable would happen on a host machine, and we're going to get into that in a minute. So hold on just a second, and I'll clarify that. Yes?
When you do get that, not host unreachable, but
destination unreachable.
Yeah, when you get that, is the last guy that was up there, is that the router?
That's the router that gave you the message, yes. And so when you do a trace route, which we'll get into in a minute, and you get a list of routers, and then the last one listed that says host unreachable, that's the router your packet got to, and that router didn't know anything to do with it. It had no route table entry to tell it what to do. Now we're going to talk about the next question. Now that we know what a router does, and now that we know what route tables are, the question is, how do these route tables get built? Where do they come from? Well, the simple way is a static route. And you've heard this term, static route. That means the operator went over and typed the route in. Somebody actually went to the router, hooked up to the console, and typed that route table entry into the machine. A dynamic route is one that the router has learned from some other router using a router-to-router protocol. As you can see, these networks can get very complex. If you had to go type by hand every route into every router everywhere in the internet, it would just never run. No one could ever do that and get it right. I mean, just a few hundred routers you had to type 20,000 entries each into would assure you would never get it right. So that's why there are router-to-router protocols. And that says that the routers can talk to each other and have sort of router gossip over the back fence about what they know about their part of the world, tell the other routers, and share information. And these protocols have a whole lot of decision-making processes in them about whether, when they get told two different things that seem to conflict, which one's stronger. And obviously, close neighbors are more reliable than faraway neighbors. And the most reliable thing in the world is what my operator told me. So static route always wins. No router protocol will override a static route.
Seems like that would actually be the least reliable.
It may be, but the router says my master typed it in. I gotta believe. So a static route always wins. Routing protocols that you're going to run into predominantly are RIP, which was the original one, and it's everywhere. IGRP was Cisco's version of RIP. They improved it quite a bit, and then they patented it, so no one but Cisco can use it. So Cisco routers, you'll see it. These protocols are really, they kind of flood the network with information. They broadcast packets everywhere. they're not very strategic, and if you get a lot of routers using this kind of protocol, you can start to chew up a lot of network bandwidth just with routers chattering to each other. So these are called interior routing protocols. You tend to use them on networks of up to 100, 200 computers, nothing much bigger. So you draw a circle around a piece of your network, you use RIP inside it. And then big internets like the internet or any intranet or any big network, you then take groups of computers that you call autonomous systems, they're called. That means basically this is all the computers that I run or that my company runs. And you draw a circle around that, and that's called one autonomous system. Another one's another one. Then you hook wires between those to build the ever bigger puzzle. To get router-to-router protocols that tell information about the world between autonomous systems, you have to go to exterior routing protocols. The most common one of those you'll run into is BGP. Again, the same general idea applies in router protocols. When you turn them on if somebody says you need to, and you set them up the way they tell you to. And really, at this level, to try to learn more about them, you really need to be interested. And it's something you have to really want to know to really learn more about it. The one thing that comes up with BGP is that if you are going to use the BGP protocol, your system has to have a globally assigned autonomous system number. Every system is numbered. Those numbers are assigned by the internet, the same place we were talking about yesterday for domain names. You go to rsinternicnet and you get what's called the ASN template, Autonomous System Number Template. You apply for that number and they'll give it to you. You do not need to do that unless you are going to use BGP. You just be wasting an autonomous system number assignment you'll never use if you get one and don't need it. And there's only 65,535 autonomous system numbers possible, so you know, don't apply for one unless you need it. You will need it if you hook to a provider who says, if you hook direct to Sprint or direct to MCI, they will generally ask you to use BGP in your router. They do not always do that. If you ask them, they can sometimes put a static route in. For instance, we hook iPads directly to Sprint backbone all the time. An iPad doesn't do BGP. And they'll put a static route in because basically you're just a Class C or three or four Class Cs at the end of a wire. They're okay with that, but you have to negotiate with them. But sometimes you'll be in a position where they'll simply say, you use BGP. We want you to be an autonomous system. We want you to use BGP. It matters a lot to our network up, cuts our workload down if you do it. And if they say that, then you will have to apply for your own autonomous system number so that you will be an autonomous system so you can program BGP in your router, because at some point it's going to say, what's your autonomous system number? Doesn't support BGP because places where iPads go don't need it. If you had to use it BGP, you would have to use another router outside the iPad. And again, from before, you can see how you would do that. You would put an outboard router and then from Ethernet hook that to the iPad. Because you can just do that as many times as you need to if a reason comes up why you have to. In general, iPads don't go places that need BGP. I'm telling you about it, though, because it could come up. And I just want you to know, if somebody throws the words BGP and autonomous system numbers at you, I want you to know what they mean. Yes?
Is the ability to do dynamic routing based on the size or cost of the router?
No, the question is the ability to do dynamic routing based on the cost and size of the router? No. It's generally in every router. I don't know of any router that doesn't have some dynamic protocol in it, other than a stub end of the line router like a trumpet windsock or something. But iPad will do RIP and RIP 2, which is plenty of routing protocol to do multiple networks around your room. Generally that's enough. And if you get bigger than that, BGP and OSPF is another name. Open Shortest Paths First is what OSPF stands for. Those are the two big ones that are in use. There's 100 kinds of protocols, but most of them are not widely used. But the idea of using a router-to-router protocol is to ease your job of programming routers. That's the only reason to do it. And so if it's hard to figure out the router protocol and easy to type in the three routes in the route table, use static routing. If the static routes get tough to figure out, turn on RIP and let the routers talk to each other and figure it out. That's really what it comes down to. In routing, the tool we use is traceroute, and it allows finding the routing path from one to the end, one end to the other. We're going to go through that right after the break and show you how to interpret traceroute through some routes and show you how to put a few pieces together. I'm going to not do a whole lot of building of routes right away because I want to try to get in the basic least line overview before lunch. And then after lunch, it's going to be all lab, where we build things, build routes, do things, and learn how to actually accomplish things with the iPad and with the Cisco routers and how to put the pieces together. So I want to get all the theory out of the way before lunch today, and we're just a little bit pressed here because we got a late start. Traceroute's your tool. Many of you have probably already used Traceroute. The first thing it does is it lists all the intermediate router points in a link. It's used to locate blanket failures in routing. If you can't get through, if you get a host unreachable and it won't go somewhere, you can figure out which router is the last one it got to. And you know that from there forward, there's some sort of a problem with your route. It also, Traceroute will time routes. It does pings to each router, and you can see the timings. So you can use it to find slow portions of a link. For instance, if you've got a T1 to a router, and the other end has a T1 to a router, and somebody put a 56K line between them, and you wonder why you're not getting good performance, you can use Traceroute to sort of smoke that kind of thing out. It's a pretty coarse tool. It won't let you get down to real solid detail, but you can find egregious problems pretty easily with it. I mean, if something's really wrong, you can generally spot it. Again, remember, I put this back because by now it's probably getting hard to remember already why we're doing this. Routing is the process which creates logical circuits between the computers on the network. That's what routing's all about. So there's a tool that we provide you. And I think this tool will be on the disk that you get at the end of the class. And it's on my desktop somewhere. Where did it go? Oh, here it is. This is a program we have and we provide to anyone with an iPad. It's in the iPad.